Hello and welcome to Iowa Ed Chat Live. We continue to bring you the latest educational news each month, and we are pleased to be able to reconnect with you tonight. It's been a little while, but we are so pleased to see all of you this evening. We have a very special guest tonight. Rick Wormley is here with us, and he's going to be chat about some grading things, some assessment things, and some excellent instruction with us and our team. We're really looking forward to that, and we will introduce Rick in just a couple of minutes. As you can see, tonight's chat will have a live video stream, and we will be taking questions from the audience. So if you do have questions or thoughts, please submit those via our hashtag, which is hashtag IAEdChat on Twitter. We will monitor that Twitter feed, so please do not hesitate to share your thoughts. We will get our show on our podcast a little later on this evening. If you've not checked us out on Apple Podcasts or Podomatic and now on Spotify and on Google Play, subscribe to us. Give us a rating. Check us out. We'd really appreciate that. At this time, we are going to introduce our team members, and I will start. My name is Dan Butler. I am a principal at Epworth Elementary School within Western Dubuque Schools, and pleased to be able to connect with everyone tonight. I'm going to pass it over to Andrea.
Hey, everybody. My name is Andrea Townsley, and I am a school improvement consultant with Grant Wood Area Education Agency in and around Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So I'm super excited to welcome Rick tonight, and I will send it over to Nick.
Hello, everybody. Nick Duffy, principal of Jackson Elementary in Cedar Rapids. Excited to be here and chat with you all this evening as we talk with Rick tonight. So welcome to EdChat, everybody. And speaking of Rick, I'm going to share a little bit about him. Rick was one of the first nationally board-certified teachers in America. Rick brings innovation, energy, validity, and high standards to both his presentations and his instructional practice, which includes 39 years teaching math, science, English, physical education, health, and history, as well as coaching teachers and principals. He is the author of 9 books and several additional publications. Rick is currently working on his first young adult fiction novel and a new book on changing the culture of a school for ethical grading practices. Welcome, Rick.
Hey, thank you, Nick and Dan and Andrea. It's an honor to be here. Hope Iowa is doing well this fine evening.
We're doing great. I think we're doing great. Well, I'm going to start with our first question this evening, and that is just tell us about yourself and your experiences in education.
Oh, my gosh. Well, there was a point in second grade where I told my parents I was going to be a doctor or a teacher. And I even tutored like children in the street. And then in high school, I started doing autopsies. My mom was a pathologist. I became a biology major at Virginia Tech, but then I ran into inorganic and organic chemistry and decided to get a life. So I have this biology background, but not so hot in inorganic and organic chemistry. And I was also a writer for the college newspaper. So I pretty much turned into education. I never looked back. It was never a regret. But there were some things that I said in the exit interview at my college, where they said, you know, what could we have done differently? What are you anticipating in life and all stuff? And I remember thinking very clearly, there were a few spots that I really felt like it lacked, you know, to some degree. And they became the focus of the first books I wrote and some of the later books I wrote, one of which is the grading book that we're going to talk about later, Fair Isn't Always Equal. What I did is I graduated. I went to work in middle schools. I did have a chance to work in kindergarten and second grade for a little bit. But the rest of my career has been more secondary. But I kind of feel like I've stepped a toe in all the levels. And then very early in my career, they started saying, hey, could you start coaching new teachers and then some other teachers? And would you write articles? And those articles created a critical mass for my first book. And then now, of course, I'm working these new books. And I had the one come out in April, and I have another one coming out in December from ASCD. And I started getting asked to coach schools here in America and around the world, and it just kind of took off from that. Does that satisfy? Is there anything else you want to know?
That's fantastic.
That's perfect.
Yeah, that's great, Rick. Thanks for the intro there. I think we know some of the answers to these questions that we're going to ask, but tell us about your passions in education and the things that are driving you to do what you do.
Passions will change, you know, every year. And every year I kind of think about, what am I going to unlearn this year? Those things in which I've grown complacent or indifferent or not recognize my own internal bias. And it's kept me from actually opening doors to students, let alone myself, or evolving. So I'm very intense on the teacher intellect and professionalism and creativity, because I think that atrophies when you've been teaching the same thing year after year after year. I'm also very passionate because I see it as a civil rights issue about fair grading practices. And I don't think it's too weird for a faculty to get together and somebody to say, is this the moral thing we've done? I've always been struck by Doug Reeves, who said, absent a moral imperative, nothing changes. And I've gotten bogged down in the logistics. I don't know how to pull this off. This is overwhelming. How are we going to fill in this document? And I've lost my dedication to some education causes because I lost sight of the ethics, the moral thing of what we do. So teacher disposition has become a huge thing, and putting that ethics in front of teachers. So that includes grading, but also includes talking candidly about racism. And then, of course, that talks about differentiation and equitable practices. And then for as long as I've been a teacher, I've taught math, science, PE, you know, social studies, history, government, but I have also always been, every single year, an English or language arts or reading teacher at the same time. So literacy is huge to me. Summarization techniques, the world of cognitive linguistics. I wrote a whole book on metaphors and analogies, which is just this lost opportunity every day that teachers in science and math and coding and music and art and history and social studies don't avail themselves of analogies and metaphors, because that can have many epiphanies for so many students. All of those collectively, literacy, summarization, racism, differentiation, cognitive science, I think your greatest tool, treasure chest as a teacher is your expertise in the human mind, and then personal creativity, intellect, the way those all intersect, and we meet those needs to create this creative, dynamic classroom that ultimately leads kids to their own self-efficacy, that they will take on the world and that I get out of their way. But maybe a part of me, my contribution is mediating relevance. That all acquiesces into some, hopefully some cogency that leads to, this is what Rick really stands for in teaching. So the idea that I'm still excited, you know, my 39th year as I was the first year, that's also a great value to me as well.
Thanks for that. That's an element I think that myself and our viewers wouldn't necessarily know when we hear Rick Wormley. We think of assessment grading and all of the things that you've written so passionately about in the past, but that's a great peek into what's on your mind right now and what's working and what you're seeing within your experiences. So thank you for going in depth on that. We really appreciate that.
Thanks. More information than you wanted to know, I'm sure.
Nope, we love it. You mentioned a little bit your book that you had talked about briefly, but we're going to dig a little bit into that now. One of your most successful books was just re-released in a second edition, Fair is Not Always Equal. It was one of the very first books that I ever read about differentiation and grading. So I would love to know, and I'm sure our viewers would like to know, tell us about the premise of the book, just in case someone hasn't read it, but then also what's new in the second edition.
Oh my gosh, I'm really excited about it. It's like 40 to 50% thicker. So it makes a really good doorstop. No, not really. We did a lot of new stuff. I don't think you should redo an edition of a book if it's just a few cosmetic changes. So I wanted to wait till in depth. So it's 11 years in the making and insights have changed. We've added so many new ideas with sports eligibility, grading gifted, whole new ideas about redos and retakes. And one of the chapters I really love is chapter 2, and that is, if you weren't a hypocrite, how would you manifest your teacher beliefs? How would you make them actionable? Because a lot of teachers lift up platitudes, syrupy sweet comments about, I believe this, like grades should be accurate, all children can learn, I have to find the right pathway. And I said, you know, if you weren't a hypocrite and you really did it, what would it look like in your grading policies and your daily classroom interactions? And it can be quite startling if you do an audit of how you have integrity. I believe this, and here are the actions and policies of my class that reflect that. And when teachers do that, sometimes it's such a candor, they realize they weren't really following through. They were just giving it lip service. So that's chapter two. We also expanded the chapter on rubrics, which does talk about the fact that rubrics actually limit children, if you're not careful, to what the current generation thinks is excellent or salient. And so a lot of us go to rubrics when we want to be evidence-based, which is fine for diagnostic stuff, formative stuff, see if you can monitor progress towards a goal, but it does limit the next generation. So one of the ideas in there is that children should always transcend the evaluative criteria on a rubric. The basic premise of the book, though, is that we get really, really caught up in, are we teaching students personal responsibility, self-discipline, how to meet deadlines? Are we doing grades as percentages or rubric numbers, or what are our proficiency scales? What about redos and retakes when it comes to kids who might need more time? How do you grade special ed in a regular class? What are college admissions officers looking for? And the idea that we have all these students and no one of us learns in a uniform timeline, but we arbitrarily impose timelines and we think that learning is an easy schematic when really it's quite messy. Three steps forward, two steps back. So the idea that one, we understand what is differentiated instruction. I blow away some of the myths that are out there, like alternative assessment. If a child can't demonstrate evidence this way, could he demonstrate the same evidence this other way? And it's not foo-foo fluff. It is actually very substantive. And you're rallying around evidence, not the vehicle used to represent the evidence or to convey the evidence. So if I know he understands photosynthesis, but he can't do my multiple choice test, or he can't write very well, then I find an alternative angle because the grade reports the evidence against a standard, not his compliance with jumping through a teacher's hoops. Well, all of these factors and these issues, these challenges, become a problem if you have diverse students. So I have a lot of English language learners in my class, and I can't let the lack of language skill get in the way of revealing what they know about math or science or whatever it is I'm assessing. So I had to write a book that I never had in college. This was one of the areas that I actually admonished my undergraduate professors, because I would have these courses in statistics and education measurement, like the Wechsler and different, like, oh, here's standard deviation. But no, I wanted to know, how do you design quizzes and give formative feedback and do formative assessment? How do you design tests? How do I do my grading? And I never had that book. So the book talks about differentiation, and then it talks about what is evidence and mastery. And then it gets into two major sections, assessment and all of its issues, the burning controversies in general, let alone when you work with different students of different cultural backgrounds, different readiness. And then what do you do with the grading of it? And running through all of that, of course, is what's the ethical thing, not just the accurate thing. And it's meant to do three things. One, to validate what people are already doing that's very effective and actually measures up to modern pedagogical practice. I try to bring us, you know, the 21st century. But two, to provoke, to make things slightly uncomfortable, to question what we've always done as the way to always do it, and make that acceptable. And three, to make it so compelling, this little dab into these areas that, and I have recommended resources, that they'll pursue it beyond the reading of the book. If it does those three things, we're really good. And, you know, since the first book came out, the first version of it, way back like 2006 or so, there's been a flood of new books out there. There used to be like five or six go-tos, like Ken O'Connor and Tom Gusky and Rick Stiggins and Jay McTighe, Grant Wiggins. And now everybody's kind of getting into it and kind of navigating and sorting their way. And we need everybody's insight in this. And, you know, things that I share in the book right now, we might augment or revise when the next edition comes out in another 10 years. But that's the basic premise, to be practical and provocative and principled in assessment and grading, particularly when you have different students in your class.
Thank you for sharing that. We do have a question, and it is kind of along the lines of grading. And we will touch on grading a little bit later too. But Heath at True Blue HES says, a question for Rick. When thinking of teachers who are traditional in their grading practices, What is the easiest practice for them to change initially toward a more standards-based approach?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because a lot of us are like, where do we start? You know, how do we pull this off? And whether it's more conservative, more liberal, more progressive, less progressive, it always comes down to, are you evidentiary? So can you prove to me, as we have a conversation, that you're really rallying around evidence, not jumping through a teacher's compliance moves? So not like, you know, every single thing that is an expression of like, did you have a nice, neat notebook? Did you use a quiet indoor voice? Did you practice personal hygiene successfully? Although at the high school level and middle school, less acts, please. Whatever it might be, that you are proving that the grade reflects evidence of a standard, nothing else. And there's a lot of things that would impugn that, where we use grades as bribery or compensation. So the idea that you would take your standards and break them down in terms of what constitutes evidence of each proficiency level, and then you would actually calibrate that evidence with a subject-like colleague. You would actually say, when it comes to this thing we both teach, what's excellent, what's almost excellent, what's emergent, what's developing, and so on. After that, that you become, or maybe simultaneously to it, you become very good at saying, is this coming to know? This is formative. They're going to get critique, feedback, and be allowed to revise their learning and their assessment in light of it. Or is this final declaration of all there is? There is no more. In other words, you get very mindful about formative versus summative. And you look at your grade book and you sit there and go, you know, am I setting the grade book up according to activities? Like quizzes count this much, labs count this much, writings this much, homework this much, or am I setting it up according to the role it plays in the learning? So this is all coming to know, which needs to be a safe place that is not high stakes. It's low stakes, but high feedback, which means it's going to contribute to the learning rather than contributing to the evaluation. That we begin to see formative assessment as data, information, not a judgment high or low. And that the summative is actually the final declaration. If you take those two and really concentrate on that for a year or three, I think the other stuff will come online. Because, for example, if you say, I'm going to have formative and I'm going to have summative, then you begin to start thinking about descriptive feedback techniques where students can help self-monitor, which again is one of the ones from John Hattie and so many others that has a high impact if you look at, you know, the meta-analyses of thousands of studies. But that's going to lead to your conversation and wrestling with redos and retakes. And it all started, though, with you being very clear-minded, making the implicit explicit when it comes to evidence. Does that help?
Great. Thank you, Rick. You also write articles for the Association of Middle Level Educators, or AMLE. Tell about your article on the change process or acceptance of new ideas.
Yeah, I just want to add that I do write articles for Education Leadership and Ed Week and other magazines and newspapers in case they're curious. Sorry, the article you were referencing was which one?
About change processes and accepting new ideas.
Yeah, that's available online. If anybody's curious, they can go to my website, which is just myname.com. Well, not M-Y-N-A-M-E, but rickwormley.com. But they can just type in The Grief of Accepting New Ideas. That's the name of it. And then Wormley, it will come up. And the premise there is that when a teacher has to let go of something that they've been doing a long time, it's a loss of identity. You know, this is the way I operate. This is who I am. And when you tell me that it's wrong, I have staked my reputation on telling you things that were truthful. And now I find out it's limited. There's a sense of guilt. Do I need to call my former students and apologize? But everybody thought I was competent when really, and I thought I was competent. And there's a grieving process. In order to accept a new idea, I have to first admit what I was doing was less effective than my ego thought it was. But ego gets in the way. And when you invoke a teacher's ego, defensive walls go up. And so what we found is every teacher, and it depends on the issue, takes a longer or shorter amount of time to accept a new idea and change your practice. And sometimes that comes out as anger, bitterness. But what we find is when you push back, you're sorting your thinking. You're like saying, yeah, but what about this? And that's very natural. Doug Reeves got me into that. He shared lots of ideas with me. But he got me into that and said, you know, if something new doesn't cause people to cry out, then it probably is not the thing you want to change, because it's not demonstrably different enough, significantly different enough to warrant all that time and energy. And when people just say, yeah, that's fine, we're going to integrate technology everywhere, that could be a form of sabotage, of indifference. I will put up with it to tell you I'm doing it, but I'm just going to go ahead and do my own thing. You want the candor. You want the pushback. And so I would worry if I was instituting something and it wasn't causing people to go, hey, wait a minute, you know, about it and really think about it. But the idea that we embrace the grief as a positive is a lot of what that article is about. And that we also can frame things in ways that don't invoke ego, and be mindful that ego is a very healthy thing. It gives you a sense of confidence that you know what you're doing. It protects you from adversity. You know, you can power through, but it's very, very fond of its opinions and it can get stuck in the mud. So do we check ego at the door? Do we get Brené Brown about it and dare greatly, which means that we make ourselves vulnerable? For example, in the conversation we just had about evidence, if I lay out, I think this is important, and I'm a 2 or 3 year veteran, but you're a 23 year veteran or a 35 year, you're going to know more. And if I share with you what I think is important, it makes me vulnerable to you, because you'll find fault, limitation in my thinking. Yet we're teaching the exact same thing in fourth grade social studies or you know, 11th grade physics. And so I don't want to do that. And so we don't talk to each other, because you might find out I don't know as much as you. And, you know, I'm struck by Thomas Newkirk. Some of you know his wonderful book. I was just happy to look through it tonight. This one here about embarrassment. The idea that it's an underlife in terms of the way teachers talk to each other, the way we ask questions, and whether or not students will actually do homework or whatever it is, it's a huge factor. And I think school faculties do themselves a service by paying more attention to the ego of teachers and the grief they go through by giving up something that which they held very strongly this whole time. But that's actually progress, and that's evolution, and it keeps it fresh. And it's re-energizing if done the correct way.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Yeah, that's tremendous. So, Rick, we've got another question from the audience. And okay. This one is coming from Charlie Heimer. And he asks, what's your number one coaching technique to use with veteran teachers? We talked a little bit about the change process just in this last question and leading new things, particularly with some veterans that you referenced there. But do you have a go-to or a number one technique for leading change or coaching veteran staff?
Yeah, I actually do. You should always start with common ground. So, you know, a good coach might help the teacher pull the camera lens back and look at the larger questions. For example, we're really struggling with homework, and, you know, we're struggling with, do we count attendance if you're walking in the room or at your seat? You know, whatever it happens to be that we're focused on, and pull the camera lens back and ask the larger questions of, why do we have homework? Why do we have school? Why do we have grades? Whose voice is not heard in our deliberation? But we try to come to commonality. What do we really, really agree on? And from there, like, for example, in grading, we might say, yes, grades should be accurate. Great, great, that's good. Let's take a look at what we know makes a grade inaccurate versus a grade that makes it accurate. And we can start talking into the nitty gritty. And then it kind of holds up a lens to, you believe this, think you're doing this, but maybe you're not. The second thing, very quickly following on those heels of that first step, is the commonality, is this idea of, tell me how you learned your craft so well. How did you learn to be a teacher or a principal or a superintendent, whatever it is? And I want to hear the minutia. I want you to go through the nitty gritty. And we find lots and lots of parallels with a lot of the things in differentiation, standards-based grading, and modern teaching effectiveness. That's really good. Good. And when we get to assessment and grading, I talk about, let's take a look how you're evaluated. And let's take a look at how anybody in the world outside of school is evaluated. So CPAs, pharmacists, police officers, architects, and so on. And we find a lot of crossover there. So once I've established those three things, how'd you learn your craft? How are you evaluated? And then, of course, where we have in common, we get to it. The last thing, and maybe overall arching, is this. There are many schools that have an instructional coach or a cognitive coach. And those skill sets are incredibly vital for individual teachers, every single one of them, to have. It will affect the way you mentor yourself, the questions you ask to kind of edit yourself and audit yourself as you're going through this. But as you work with students, as you work with other colleagues. So the idea that as a coach, I would ask you questions so that you came to your own conclusions, not me passively just telling you what your conclusion should be. So I'm going to ask questions to which I don't already know the answers, something a lawyer should never do. But I'm also not going to telegraph my opinion on that. I remain non-judgmental. So I'll say, tell me more about that. What was your goal? How do you know you will achieve your goal? What would you do the next time you taught? This is the first go-to. So if you were to get up to speed on cognitive coaching, now I've written a whole article on that. I have a slideshow on that I can send people. And you can type in cognitive coaching and my name, it will come up. But there are wonderful books out there on cognitive coaching. And the article would list some of those wonderful resources. I would get up to speed on that and memorize probably a dozen of your go-to starter questions, starter sentences, where you don't telegraph your judgment or evaluation, because that would invoke ego and the sense of, I need to save face and save honor. And then those other three added to that, those would be my go-tos. I hope that worked for Mr. Clymer.
Yeah, I think so. That was fantastic. We're going to keep going with what we've prepared for you. So talking about motivating and making connections with students is another topic with which you've written and spoken about. So talk to us about this very important issue of motivating and making connections with students.
Well, I got to tell you that I think a lot of teachers and schools have it wrong. They try to motivate kids and motivate teachers. But let's just stick with the students. Motivation is something that's very internal. It's very intrinsic. The only person that can motivate himself or herself is that person. So I think schools really should stop trying to motivate. That's the wrong pursuit. What we can do is increase the likelihood that you'll invest in this environment or this particular things. You will find it worthy of your time and energy. We are in the art of persuasion. Way back in 1979, there was a poetry book for teachers. It was called Chalk Dust by Elspeth Murphy. 1979 Chalk Dust. And in one of her poems, she had a line, if I had been a child in my class today, would I want to come back tomorrow? And I think that we have to convince kids this is worthwhile. But kids only get excited. They only invest in things they perceive they have the skill set to do, not necessarily where they perceive that they are incompetent. So a big part of my day is to make sure every single child experiences competence and not leaving competence to chance. So I want them to invest. So I make sure that there's some place where they can bring their assets, their tools to bear and find that success. And then, of course, nothing motivates like success. So I have to make progress very visible to pull that off. If you were to study student motivation, self-discipline, follow through, perseverance, all these wonderful things, you would not find one research study that says, or TED Talk, one video that says use grades to do it. A lot of teachers who do not have a background in human motivation, self-efficacy, empowerment, they overly rely on the grade book for classroom management and student motivation. And it just exacerbates the problem. The over-reliance on external validation. I don't know that I'm worth anything unless you tell me how I am. Or get into Albert Bandura's attribution theory. That there are things that I can't control, so I might as well develop learned helplessness. So if you were to study learned helplessness and self-efficacy and self-discipline, you would find all these wonderful things like executive function. It turns out an executive function, which doesn't come online for most of us until 18 to 25, we find all these practical tips on how to get kids to remember their homework and not leave it at home or in their locker. How to get kids to care about deadlines. When a project is assigned, to actually start it when it was assigned instead of wait till the night before it was due. To actually care about work. We find so many wonderful things in there. And instead, a lot of teachers are knocking their heads against the wall, given zero after zero after zero when a child doesn't follow through or do something or doesn't act motivated. And then we wonder why. And my response is, you know, how's that working for you? So if you want to build tenacity, you want to study what we know about building tenacity and perseverance and motivation, not over rely on kind of this grading, this idea of manipulation and bribery. It is so much more than that. And if folks are interested, I can recommend a lot of resources on it. But a big part of that is developing the mutual ethos. I look out for you, you look out for me. So that's relationship building. And I've written about that in Education Leadership. If people are curious, I can point them to the article. But if a student respects me as a teacher, and I say, I now want you to do small group work, and they hate small groups, they drag their feet, they groan when it's small group, because they either are always the dead weight the group has to carry, or they are the one that does all the work and nobody does anything else. They're gonna like, oh, I hate small groups. I'm not gonna, oh wait, it's Mr. Warmly and I respect him. I will do this. I will climb mountains for him if I have that respect. I want that relationship. And I wonder with teachers, do they have somebody like that in their lives? If they were to call them and ask them to do a task that they really don't like, would they first go, oh, it's her that's calling me. Yeah, I'll be right over. And so I'm hoping teachers have that because they're more likely to kind of see the positives when they do it with students. So I'm going to look out for the student. I'm going to honor what they bring to learning's table. And I'm going to forge positive relationships, not just say, look, you don't have to like me. Here's a Jolly Rancher, so you smile, a form of bribery. You come here, you do your job, I do my job, we don't have to like each other. No, I think that actually has play. That students, if they enjoy the experience, will likely to invest in it more. And I think there are ways to you do it where you're very, very demanding. I'm not soft on kids. My reputation is one of, if you're a slacker, you don't want me as your teacher, because I'll get in your face and I'll save you from yourself, so to speak. I won't let you escape the burden or the demands of your learning, but I will share the path with you and I will not label you. And F's and zeros are recoverable, not the final destiny or epitaph, you know, on your academic tombstone. So I think that relationship building and studying how we build perseverance in others would go a long way over some more antiquated notions when it comes to motivation. And yeah, a lot of these articles that which I'm mentioning are available on the website or just online. Just type in the topic and my name, they should come up.
So just to follow up a little bit on that, obviously you're talking about teacher to student relationship and how that in and of itself is the motivator, right? And I just have to think about this. I'm a principal. The bulk of my day is working with adults. Obviously, I work with children as well. But for our principals, for our instructional coaches, for our people in positions where they're working primarily with adults, we're talking the same language here, are we not?
Yes. And we're also talking, you know, phrasing things that don't invoke ego, like we mentioned before, where they have to save face and save honor. They'd rather just give you a nod. What do cornered animals do? But one of the things that I find is I have to find that or create a situation where you are so dissatisfied with the current situation. You see the limit of that. And as I mentioned in the article, and you know, I totally got this idea from Robert Evans, The Human Side of Social Change, back in 1996, that I have to make you aware of your role in that dissatisfaction. So much that you're so dissatisfied with the current situation, you're willing to make a stretch, make a change for that. But the exact same things we use with kids often work with teachers. And I am really perpetually struck by Dan Pink and Drive and those three motivating factors. So with my teachers and colleagues, let alone with my students, I have to make sure they're experiencing mastery. They really have the skill set to do it, the competence, but also autonomy, that I'm letting them have choice. And the way they pursue that, I'm not insulting their professionalism, but also a sense of purpose. that they're a part of something larger than themselves. They really see that what they do matters, and rather dramatically, absent those or any one of those things, the motivation of teachers kind of falls off. So, you know, the big picture that we provide students is what a principal or a colleague can provide a colleague or a faculty member. You were once here and now you are here. Let me show you the big picture of how you have moved. My wife and my daughter do P90X. I would do that, but I travel a lot and that's my story and I'm sticking to it. But in P90X, you have to take photos of your changing body shape. You have to do the muscle measurements or the slimming waist. And when you see that little progress along the way, which as a principal, I would have to make visible, you're way more inclined to stick with it. So I'm going to look at all the attributes of self-efficacy, tenacity, perseverance, and how you cultivate that. And I'm definitely going to do the same thing with teachers. For example, if I want teachers to do descriptive feedback that doesn't invoke ego and makes students want to dive in and analyze their work without fear of judgment, the safe place to do it, and really grow and benefit as a result, I'm going to do that as a principal. I'm going to do that as a leader. So they feel the positives, they're way more likely to do that with the students they serve. So as much as I can, whatever degree I can, the things I want them to do, like differentiate, assess according to evidence, you know, all these different things, technology integration, I'm going to do that because actions speak louder than words.
That's tremendous. Thank you so much for going there with that follow-up there, Rick. Really appreciate that. That's great stuff. Great stuff.
I hope it's useful.
Absolutely. This next question, you've hit a little bit on grading practices, but we're going to ask you a question. And I think Chris Felicello has asked a question, what are your thoughts on grading homework? But I think you may be able to answer this with this question. And maybe you'll touch on this and maybe you won't, but grading is another passion of yours. What are we getting wrong in education in regards to grading? And what are we getting right?
Well, first of all, can I just say to the whole galaxy that Chris is an education hero of mine and everybody should be following him online. I can't wait to read his first book. It's going to be awesome. Having said that, and yes, Chris, I'll expect the $20 in the mail. No, not really. Getting to homework questions, some other questions. We keep including things in evidence that are not evidence of a standard. And so one of the bottom line guideposts really should be we grade against standards, not the routes children take to those standards, which means anything that is a teacher technique or a learner method is now suspect. Now, I hope people don't misquote me. You're allowed to, if you need to, grade some of these things if you absolutely need to, but it's always reported separately. And then the second follow-up would be, but look at the research and anecdotal evidence. You shouldn't be grading those other things. You should be giving feedback, but not the judgment, the grade, because that shuts down the analysis and the growth from it. So what are we getting right? More and more schools are turning to evidence-based, proficiency-based, competency-based grading, and those can have different terms in different states. I'm aware of that. Don't worry. But the idea that grades mean what they say, that they have integrity, nationwide is 40%. California, last time I saw a few years ago, was about a half of all students. So I don't know what it is for the individual places, but in many, many places, it's 40% rising. It's the number of kids who leave high school that go to college that have to retake high school classes in college because the grades are false reports. So there are some scary, scary things that have to happen to teachers. For example, I do a unit in October and the child gets an A or a very high score, a high grade. But then I include questions of that unit on a later unit test, later in the year, and he doesn't know it. What do I do? Do I keep the other grade and average it in at the end of the year in the transcripts? Or do I go back and say, look, you don't know this, so I'm now lowering your grade? The grade has to have integrity. And what we found is, and more schools are moving towards this, but they're not all there yet, is the most recent evidence counts most of all. So we grade on a trend. We don't count the earlier evidence. So earlier evidence of incompetence cannot be a part of the report of current competence. It's just like if a child takes a quiz and he bombs it, but 2 weeks later, I ask the same questions on the big test. Well, he nails it, and I trust the validity of my test to create an accurate report. If I don't trust that, then that's another conversation we need to have. But if I do have accurate evidence of complete proficiency, I can't weave in earlier reports of non-proficiency in the current report of proficiency because that knowingly falsifies a grade. So the quiz counts zero. So now I'm in a school where it says all quizzes count 10%, or a homework counts 10%, or 20%. This is deeply unethical and troubling. And it's a false assumption they're actually teaching self-discipline. Or if I don't count homework a lot, children won't do it. Of course they will do it. Please study why children don't do homework. And it's not because of the fear or lure of the grade book nearly to the degree you think it is. It might be initially that for high-performing students, but it isn't that for low-performing. Homework has a very different role. It is practice. It is not final declaration of mastery. So no teacher would ever allow me to grade them, evaluate them on their first coming to know steps as they're learning a new teacher strategy. They would need to practice it, get critique, revise in light of that, and continue. So what are we getting right? We're moving towards becoming evidentiary. We're moving towards disaggregation, less symbol, less curriculum per symbol. If I aggregate all this stuff in a year-long curriculum into one tiny little symbol, less valid is that symbol, less useful is that symbol, and it's more of a moral dilemma when I use it to make a high-stakes decision. So I want to be standards-based. Whatever report I give really matters. It means I have to break the subject down into smaller pieces. Maybe have a separate document that really explains the subsets within those smaller subsets, but I'm trying to get less curriculum per symbol. No more using averaging, because averaging doesn't correlate with outside the school testing nearly as well as mode and median and other forms of central tendency. In fact, just this year, many colleges are now starting to look at median as actually a more accurate predictor of your true functionality and performance in whatever their accredited program is once you leave college. If I did the median of the grades, it actually reflects a bit more of your expertise. Or if I do the mode, the most consistent performance or pattern of evidence over time actually correlates with outside the school testing. So why do we hide behind the math of mean or averaging? Because we understand that math. So one of the bigger issues, I guess, in getting wrong is that we over rely or worship at the math altar to find our grading credibility or justification. And I would say, stop saying, you know, he got an 82 and thinking you're really precise. What you want to do is create some kind of grading scale where there's a symbol or a word and there's a really good evidence descriptor next to it. You're making implicit explicit. It'd be really good if we could just handwrite out descriptive narrative comments and you would get far more information. But to think that, oh, I'm more objective because I wrote 91 instead of 92. No, that's splitting hairs. It's not, it's a false sense of greater precision because you went to that minutia. The difference though, between getting into a higher level program and not getting into it is the difference between a 90 and an 89. One ridiculously small decimal point or percentage point. And then I've seen valedictorians determined by 1/10,000th of a decimal point. And that person gets all of the college scholarships and all the accolades, and everyone else of the same academic caliber is summarily rejected based on 1/10,000th of a decimal point. This is what Tom Gusky calls a mindset of you use grades to sort children to see who is worthy and who is not, kind of like the Sneetches, who has stars upon bars and who's not, or do you use grades and assessment and whole enterprise to cultivate children and their talents and their skills? And I would prefer that second one, because the first one, being a terrible teacher, Gusky says, a weak teacher exacerbates it like nothing else and makes sure it happens. So we want to make sure that we see grades for developing students and the assessment enterprise, not just sorting them. I think that's a pitfall as well. The thing that holds us back is so many adults, teachers included, this is done to me, so I'm going to do it to the next generation. Like that's a legitimate thing. We have evolved as a profession and change is a process. It's not an event, but we were hired to do hard things, not hired to do easy things. And if you're a highly accomplished professional, you'll begin to ask some of these candid questions and maybe give yourself 3 to 4 years to really kind of start making some significant moves towards a more constructive, accurate, and ethical grading policy.
some ideas there, Rick. Thank you. You know, huge paradigm shifts for what we have maybe encountered in our teacher development or other elements. So thank you for sharing those ideas. I've got a statement here that I want to gather your thoughts on. Differentiation should happen in every classroom. What do you think about that statement?
I don't think you should differentiate just to differentiate. I think you should differentiate as warranted. But if I were to go global and say every single classroom, I'm struck by what kind of a student would graduate from a K-12 system or any subset thereof, where teachers differentiated as needed. I suggest they would be far more competent. They'd be far more embracing of diversity. They would not see difference from them as less than them. They would see it as strength. So they wouldn't be threatened. They wouldn't find that hostile. They would really know their stuff, not just, oh, well, and teachers just settle for incompetence. Incompetence, lack of learning, is never maturing, never preparatory for what's to come. What really is preparatory is really learning it. And differentiation is maximizing learning over that which otherwise could have been achieved had they done one size fits all. But in the differentiation approach, the mindset, the definition, is to prepare kids for all situations that are not differentiated. So they own their learning. They develop the self-efficacy. So no, they're not going to sit in a 200 freshman college class and not be able to do well because the professor doesn't have the economy of scale to differentiate. They will own that. They'll be able to do it themselves because they know who they are. What kind of person would graduate from K-12 experience where they never differentiated? Incompetent? They probably wouldn't graduate because they wouldn't learn the stuff. And when you are incompetent at something, yet your brain is telling you you will survive, usually the only choice you have is illegal to do that, to get food and, you know, medicine and everything else. So competence is a huge thing. So should every single classroom differentiate? Yes, by golly, if the student is not thriving in whatever way it is. But it doesn't mean we do IEPs for every single child or we have to differentiate every single day. A part of differentiation is whole class instruction. Also small group, also independent, and sometimes giving support, sometimes taking away the support. One of the biggest themes for me as I approach differentiation is Oscar Wilde's reminder. The goal of any teacher is to put himself out of a job. So what am I doing to move you from dependence to independence? Differentiation is not a crutch, not even close to it. Mike Schmoker is wrong in this. In his two books, he talks about this, and what was written in Ed Week, he doesn't have it down. It's actually giving kids the skills to handle anything so there's a versatility, a dexterity. And it's also, you know, I think the child is into basketball. Okay, do I have to use a basketball analogy every single time I teach the child? No, he can do just fine with hockey and football and anything else. He can do fine with everything else the other children are doing. But if I find these examples aren't working and I know something about that child and I can weave it in to improve that learning, it kind of feels like you have a moral obligation, a professional duty to give it a shot. But if I don't know anything about the kids because I'm not vigilant, I didn't take time to get to know the kids and how they learn differently and all these different things, then I'm left with one size fits all and everything looks like a nail because all I have is a hammer. So I do understand that some teachers who don't have a versatile repertoire, they don't have 10 different ways to teach pronouns, they have the one, that they're going to be frustrated by this. But again, what do true professionals do? We constantly add to our repertoire so we have maneuverability. Now, I go into a classroom usually with only one lesson plan, but I might have identified a few students like, again, ELL, English language learners, for example, who might not have a background in academic language I'm going to be using. So for a few moments, I'm going to pull them to one side and just double check they understand the academic English that's being used. Even though they're currently conversant and fluent in English, they may not know the academic stuff. That was it. A simple augmentation at one part of it. I have some child who's just not getting the writing out sentences or whatever it is. So I asked them to use some kind of graphic sketch notes, and suddenly they get it a little bit better. They're actually getting into it more and they find it more motivating. Man, that's great. I'm going to add that to the repertoire. I've got some child who comes in espousing Republican talking points. Democrat talking points, Tea Party, Green Party, whatever the party is, I know that politics is important to him. Is there any way I could incorporate the political nature of something into something that might be boring to him? I'm going to give it a shot. But if I don't remain attentive to that and see the value of that, I'm not going to have the maneuverability, the versatility. The real root of differentiation is responsive teaching. So I won't be able to respond to the students in front of me. In fact, differentiated instruction is becoming a little bit of a hot potato in some places. People just call it what it really is, responsive teaching. So tell me what you know about the children you serve. And then tell me how you might have changed things this week to improve instruction over that which otherwise could have been achieved simply based on what you knew about the students. And I would say, well, like from The Flash, run, Barry, run.
That's great. Rick, we're coming to the end. It's been a quick hour. You have rocked this, and you're giving us so many takeaways and so many takeaways to our followers as well. So we're going to wrap up with just one more question for you, and then we're going to turn it over to you for some kind of closing final thoughts from you, and then we'll wrap up this conversation. So we want to know, what's next for you as you continue to move forward?
You know, I think it's important to have balance in life and getting better at life balance. You know, I love those books out there, Teacher and Principal Wellness. You know, Todd Whitaker and many others have written about these things. But the idea that I balance writing and personal health with professional obligations and things, that's going to be an emphasis. But I think the writing of the book on how do you shift culture for ethical grading is my next big project. And then the idea of writing fiction, young adult fiction. I'm so inspired by the great young adult fiction that's out there and child, you know, elementary level and middle grade fiction. I would love to be able to contribute to that. And it's a very different side of me, you know, out there to do that. I would love to do those things. But I think, you know, and this might be getting into the more of the final commentary too, is this idea of courage of conviction. You know, a lot of teachers say things, but to find the courage to act upon it. And, you know, I do a lot with racism. And how do you have candid conversations about race, even when it means you might lose friends for a period of time, a family as well? And so what do you value is more important than your fear? Ambrose Redmoon was a rock band manager back in the 1960s, but he was also quadriplegic, which is completely irrelevant. However, he said, courage is not the absence of fear, but it's the judgment that something else is more important than that fear. And I think a lot of teachers operate on kind of this idea of what's going to expose me to the less amount of anxiety and fear and danger, as opposed to what do I believe in so strongly I'm willing to put myself out there and invite critique. And it may or may not work, but it's always based on modern pedagogical practice, not what I learned 20 and 30 years ago as an undergraduate or what I read from a book, you know, 15 years ago. But what am I willing to do and assess right now and get candid looking at that? I think I'll probably pursue that idea that, Rick, if you're going to talk about courage, you better demonstrate your courage and facilitate, and probably we'll make some mistakes and we'll maybe burn a bridge here and there. But in overall retrospect, when you look back, you were moving forward. So that'll probably be an impetus for a while.
Well, that's all super exciting stuff that we are really excited to check out. So thank you for sharing that with us. I'm going to take just a second to share. If you do not currently follow Rick on Twitter, you can find him at RickWormley2, and you can check out his website, www.rickwormley.com. And then he also has some books for you to check out. He writes for EdWeek, Ed Leadership, and AMLE. So definitely check out some of those resources. And I'm going to put it back to you for just a closing thought to end our evening. We definitely had more questions than we had time for, and we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us tonight. So I'm going to turn it back to you for just a very quick closing thought.
Oh, please have a sense of humor. Find the laughter. It releases dopamine for mental acuity, endorphins. You will find, like, some of the stuff I've said tonight is very strident. It's very uncomfortable. But if you can also put a little laughter in there from time to time, people will settle down and really dive into the message. So if you're a leader, a classroom teacher, and sometimes people are a little bit anxious about things, always have that sense of humor or non sequitur, that really bizarre thing, just insert once in a while, shake it up, and just take everybody, take a step back and breathe. It goes a long, long way. So I hope people will carry that on.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. This has been just a highly engaging conversation tonight, and we really appreciate you taking some time with our team and our followers tonight. So I'm going to wrap things up with just a couple of logistics with some upcoming events. First off, October 14th through the 16th, everybody, is iTech. So that's the Iowa Technology and Education Connection. This is a great conference. This will be at the Iowa Event Center in Des Moines. If you are planning to go, you're going to have a great time. Attended last year, and that is a phenomenal conference. And then again, if you have local, national, regional things that you have coming up that you want us to highlight, let us know. We will. We will get those taken care of for you and push those out. So again, thank you, everybody, for joining us and sharing your thoughts on Iowa Ed Chat Live. We usually get together like this the last Sunday of every month, and it's just always great learning with all of you. A very special guest to our, a very special thank you to our guest tonight, Rick Warmly. And on behalf of Nick, Andrea, and myself, thank you for joining us on Iowa Ed Chat Live. If you've met some new people on Iowa Ed Chat Live tonight, make sure you give them a follow, continue that conversation and reflection throughout the week, and do check us out online. You can find a great deal of resources at our website. That's tinyurl.com/IAEdChat. And just one reminder, we will have this show in podcast format a little later on this evening to check that out, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podomatic, or on the Google Play Store. So check us out. That would be great. We're going to be back next week with another great topic. And until that time, be the change. Good night, everyone.